Well, it's first of all, can I just say it is great to be with you today. It's lovely to see what is happening here at the Windsor Fellowship Church and to see what is being created, all the hard work that goes into setting up each time. It requires a lot of effort and dedication, so it's brilliant to see it. Thank you too for the Wardens of St Stephen's for coming. But it's so nice to see you, and thank you for joining us on such an important occasion and enabling then these neat names of people who've been confirmed to go in the parish register. Now, I want to talk today about living in a world of unbelief, because here we've got three people who've been confirmed. They say they want to be known as followers of Jesus Christ, and it's not going to be terribly easy, because most of the people around us don't believe the same things. And therefore, the question is, how do we keep going? You know, what does God have to say about this? Now, confirmations are interesting, aren't they? You know the old joke that if your church building has bats in the roof and you need to get rid of them, just get the vicar to confirm them and you'll never see them again. Well, at its heart, confirmation isn't just sort of some sort of rite of passage after which people then move on with their lives. At its heart, it's about people's desire to be known as followers of Christ. Not an easy thing. Not easy because in our culture, we've got things like the writings of Richard Dawkins. We've got the rise of religious extremism. We've got the debates on ethical issues ranging from euthanasia to the nature of marriage. And all of those things have sort of come together in a sort of perfect storm to make Christians seem very much in the minority and certainly on the back foot. So what is it that Christians want to say to the unbelieving world, and what is going to sustain them for the future? Well, I think this is where today's passage is going to help us, because it shows us Jesus confronting unbelieving people and also reassuring those who follow him. So let's see what we can learn from it as we go through verses 22 to 42 together. The first thing is we discover that Jesus challenges the world's view of God. Jesus challenges the world's view of God. The poet Shelley said, "If God has spoken, why is the world not convinced?" And he said that because to him, God needed to do things in a particular way if he was going to prove his existence to Shelley. And indeed, from Shelley's point of view, to everybody else. And that's not unlike the view that many people today take of God, is it? You know, if we're going to believe in God, then he needs to do a number of things. He needs to answer my prayers immediately. He needs to give me a miraculous healing. He needs to send me an angel with a personal message. We have all sorts of ideas, don't we, on how God could prove himself. That last one about, you know, I'd believe in God if he sent an angel to speak to me. There's a lovely story told by Elaine Storkey, who was an evangelical member of the General Synod. She said she was getting a train to go to York for the General Synod. And it was in the days where you could run for trains and fling open the door as it was moving and jump in, not unlike, you know, the trains of today, where you have to be there in advance if you stand any chance of getting in at all. So there she was, belting after this train to catch it. She flung open the door, chucked her case in, then heaved herself in, and then closed the door after as they left the station, flopped down in the seat opposite, sort of panting and sitting, and she discovered she was in a compartment with one other person, and they were sort of looking at her. Well, they sort of nodded to one another. Elaine Storkey got her papers out for the General Synod, started going through them, and after a bit, the person opposite said, "Oh, I see you're something to do with the church." "Yes," said Elaine Storkey, I'm going to the General Synod of the Church of England." "Oh. Never believed in God myself." "Oh, really? Why is that?" Well, it's all too much to believe." And they started chatting, and then eventually the woman said, "No, if I was going to believe in God, he would, I would need him to send a special messenger to me to tell me. And Elaine Storkey put her papers down, leaned across to the woman and said, God has sent me to tell you about Jesus Christ. And the woman's face went white. But it's true, isn't it? He sent anybody who knows Jesus Christ has been sent to pass on the good news of Jesus. But let's come back to theme, which was how people believe that God needs to sort of display himself in particular ways if they're going to believe him. And then there are others around who say, well, I do believe in God, but I just don't believe in God your way. I believe there are many ways to God. You know, I think he's like the summit of a mountain where, you know, we can all get there even though we go up different paths. Now, to the Jews of Jesus' day, God, they knew, was going to send his promised Messiah, the great deliverer of his people. But their view was that when he came, he needed to display such tremendous power that he would immediately dispose of the Roman occupiers of their land. And for the Jews of Jesus' day, the Messiah certainly wouldn't be the sort of person who went around saying the sorts of things that he does in verses 11 to 18 of chapter 10. Because four times in verses 11 to 18, just before the passage we read started today, four times he said that he has come to lay down his life. He has come not to turf the Romans out, but to die. Now, that, of course, did not meet their presuppositions about what God should do at all. And it's presuppositions about God and what God should be like that very often stops people from understanding the evidence that is before their very eyes. So at the end of John's Gospel, as you probably know, when you get right to the end of chapter 20, verse 30, he explains why he has written his gospel. He says this: Jesus did many other signs in the presence of the disciples, which are not written in this book, but these are written so that you may believe Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name. In other words, here are eyewitness accounts of the miracles Jesus did, and the whole point of them was not to say Christians today can expect to go around doing exactly the same things. No, the point of them was to say, here are miracles which are acting like signposts pointing to the fact that Jesus really is the Christ, the Messiah, the Son of God. But because of their presuppositions, the reaction of people, well, the reaction is summarized in verses 20 and 21, isn't it? You see, they either said, here's a man claiming to be God, so he must be mad. So many of them said he has a demon and is insane, why listen to him? Or, it's verse 21, others said, these are not the words of one who is oppressed by a demon. Can a demon open the eyes of the blind? In other words, they were saying, hang on a minute, look at the evidence. Look at what he's doing. Now, Jesus' opponents just don't want to be persuaded by that evidence. So in verse 31, they're turning murderous, aren't they? And they're turning murderous not because of the evidence of the miracles, but because Jesus has disrupted their view of God. And Jesus appeals to them. In verse 38, he says, look, you know, even if you can't take on board what I'm saying about myself, at least recognize that in the miracles that I'm doing, God is at work. At least recognize the force of God in these miracles and that God is working through me. But they won't even do that. In verse 30, Jesus is quite clear. He and his Father are completely at one in all Jesus is doing. And what he does is extraordinary. He has just in chapter 9 regenerated the eyes of a blind man. Back in chapter 6, he created food for 5,000 people. In chapter 4, he rescues someone from the point of death. All of these things showing extraordinary divine, creative and redeeming power. And if he is acting completely in line with his Father's will, then what he says about himself and his purpose in coming into the world must also be true. So why did he come into the world? John 3:16, whoever believes in him shall not perish, but have eternal life. But people don't like the idea that they need to come to Christ to have life. Yet that's where the evidence points, isn't it? That's where the evidence points. So first, Jesus challenges the world's view of God. Now secondly, Jesus protects those given to him by God. Jesus protects those given to him by God. Now, I don't know how many of you have tried to share the gospel with somebody else who isn't a Christian. If you've done so, I wonder what the reactions have been. Because as like as not, they've either been a sort of a half smile followed by, well, I must be going now. Or you've got somebody who wants to know more. I wonder how many of you can remember hearing when he was alive the Australian evangelist John Chapman, known affectionately as Chapo. He was trying to teach someone how to share the gospel. And they were walking through a university campus and they saw a chap sitting under a tree, and Chapo nudged the person he was with and he says, "Go on then, give him a go, give him a go." And so this unfortunate person, keeping company with Chapo, sort of rather sheepishly goes across to the chap sitting under the tree and he sort of blurts out, "Do you mind if I tell you the gospel?" Probably with an Australian accent as well. And the chap sort of puts down his book and looks up. And he says, "No, go on then." So this chap who's being taught how to share the gospel again sort of blurts out a few things about the gospel, tries to do his best explaining how Jesus came to die for us and how we should put our faith in him. And by the time he's finished, he's completely red in the face. And he says, and he finishes by saying, "So, do you want to become a Christian?" To which the bloke sitting under the tree says, "That was undoubtedly..." He said, I've heard many people tell me the gospel, and that was undoubtedly the worst presentation I've ever heard. And then he said, "But the answer to your question is, yes, I do." Isn't it amazing? You see, when we tell people the gospel, they either warm to it or they're repelled by it. Now, why do some turn to Christ and not others? Well, we don't know really. For some, it's to do with timing, isn't it? For some, it's just not the time when they are going to turn to Christ. They will do later, but not now. I remember when I started as a vicar teaching Christianity Explored as a course. And one of the people participating was a man in his 70s. And his eyes were really opened to the Christian faith. And I remember what he said to me. He said, "The thing is," he said, "I've been coming to this church for 50 years. And I cannot understand why nobody has explained this to me before." Now, the point was that probably many people had explained it. It's just that his ears hadn't been opened to hear it and for it to lodge in his heart before. But it was right for him then. He was at the point where he could respond. But for all people, whenever they turn to Christ, the reason they turn to him, according to verse 29, is because they have been given to Jesus by his Father. In other words, if you've put your trust in Jesus, it is as though God has wrapped you up as a present and handed you over to Jesus Christ. Now, we immediately wonder, of course, why it is he's chosen us and not someone else. How can that be fair? And the answer, as I've said earlier, may simply be that it's not yet the right time for others. But apart from that, for those that never turn to Christ, we don't know why God chose some rather than others. But the reason Jesus wants us to know that God chose us and has given us to Jesus Christ is not in order to puzzle us, but to reassure us. You see, in a world of unbelief, how are we going to keep going? That's the question we ask. How do I know, if I become a Christian, that I won't just get sucked in to the way the rest of the world thinks about things and then eventually give up my faith? How do I know I'm going to be able to keep going? I can think of many people who've said to me, I don't think I ought to become a Christian because I couldn't keep it up. And the answer is, it's not up to us to do that. The answer is, God is the one who holds us firm. He chose us, he presented us to Christ, and says Jesus, nobody can snatch them out of my hand. And if you think, well, that's just him talking, he says nobody can snatch them out of the Father's hand. In other words, if you think you're just taking them away from Jesus, you're not. You're taking them away from God himself. And that's hugely reassuring. We tend to think that when we become Christians that we are taking hold of God's hand. But what we need to understand is that when we became Christians, he took hold of us. And he will never let us go. I said earlier, I fell away from Christ in my 20s. But Jesus didn't let me go. He brought me back to himself in those two ways that I described, making me miserable and making me happy with the prospect of married life, and then suddenly realizing that I needed something more for that life. So the person who says, no, I don't think I should be a Christian because I couldn't keep it up, well, he's not thinking about things the way Christ thinks about them. Because Jesus says, look, come to me. My burden is light. I'm the one who's going to keep you going. So Jesus protects those given to him by God. And then thirdly and lastly, Jesus defines the people of God. Jesus defines the people of God. You know how often people say, well, we're all God's children, aren't we? As though, you know, we'll all be acceptable ultimately. We're all God's people. Actually, according to this passage, that's not so. According to this passage, Jesus defines the people of God. You see, it started in verse 22 by saying that these events took place at the Feast of Dedication. Now, the Feast of Dedication isn't something you'll find written up in the Old Testament. There is no Feast of Dedication in the Old Testament. There was the rededication of the temple by Solomon, but the Feast of Dedication started after the end of the Old Testament period. And after the end of the Old Testament period, what happened was that the Syrian Antiochus Epiphanes desecrated the temple. Came in, took over the temple, sacrificed pigs on the altar, and it was an appalling desecration. And as a result, there were some Jews that were sort of collaborators, and there were others that resisted this, and they developed a sort of guerrilla warfare against the Syrians, led by Judas Maccabeus. And ultimately, Judas Maccabeus succeeded, and as a result, the temple was purified and worship was restored. Those who had collaborated were seen to be not truly part of the people of God. At the purification of the temple, the true people of God gathered together. And now here comes Jesus. Not Judas Maccabeus, but Jesus, walking in the temple. And once again, there's a separation between those who are truly the people of God and those who aren't. Those who are those who hear his voice in verse 27 and follow him. Now, there weren't vast numbers of them in Jerusalem at the time, it seems. But did you notice at the end of our passage, when we get to verse 41, that huge numbers are following him outside of Jerusalem? In some ways, that's a reminder of our situation here in the West, isn't it? That Christianity can seem to be a minority interest here, but elsewhere in the world, there are actually millions of people following Jesus Christ. And it is those who follow Christ who are the true people of God. So, in verse 41, we've got this reference to John the Baptist, with people saying, look, John didn't do any signs, but everything John said about this man was true. Now, John the Baptist was sort of the last great Old Testament prophet. I know he appears in our New Testament Gospels, but he's the last of the old line, so to speak. The last of the Old Testament prophets. So here is the culmination of the Old Testament, and everything John said about Jesus was true. And it's as though the whole of the Old Testament has been pointing to Jesus Christ. And the people hear his voice, and like a shepherd with his sheep, they follow him. How can you tell who the true shepherd is? Well, because the true people of God are following him. How can you tell the true people of God? Because they're following Jesus. So at confirmation today, we're reminding ourselves that it's Jesus we're following, not some vague idea about God. We follow someone who laid down his life to secure us, and when we trust in him, we are secure. We can't be snatched away. Isn't that great to know? We can't be snatched away. You might feel, some people feel a bit threatened by that, don't they? They feel, oh gracious, I'm trapped. I've made a commitment and now I can't get out of it. It's not like that at all, is it? It's like just holding the hand of the dearest person to you. And if you say, well, I can't get away from them. Well, of course you can release the hand. But you don't want to get away from them, do you? If they're dear to you, you always want them to be around for you. And the wonderful thing is that Jesus will never let us slip out of his grasp. So let's continue joyfully to hear his voice as he speaks his word, and to follow where he leads. Because as we do that, we can see that we're part of a great people that God is creating from every nation on earth to be with him forever. And these are all the things we're celebrating today. We're celebrating your confirmation that you are committed to Jesus Christ. When you committed to him, God chose you. We're celebrating the fact that God has confirmed and will confirm that you're his by the way he keeps hold of you. And we're confirming the fact that we are part of a great people, not an obscure minority. We're part of a great people who God is gathering together throughout the world, and they're identified by the fact that they're followers of Christ.